active again, but in longer format, doing some interviews and stuff, so I'm glad to hear that. But the woman behind Prison Radio, Noel Hanrahan, has a statement to some kind of conference that happened in Mexico City that was partially about Mumia Abu-Jamal's case. I think it was a broader looking at incarceration, the incarceration nation to the north of them. So I thought I'd play that and look at some of the other material that Mumia, longtime political prisoner, 4 decades now, I guess, or so. And yeah, let's do that right now while we get set up.
Greeting Mexican friends and those around the world. This is Noel Hanrahan. I'm a lawyer. I visit Mumia Abu-Jamal. I work on his medical cases, and I see him 3 to 4 times a month in person at SCI Mahanoy. His criminal legal defense cases are at an impasse. He has exhausted his direct appeals before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court for his criminal conviction. There are many paths to freedom, though this is a moment of somber reflection and a moment when we all need to understand that he has been in prison now 4 decades and has never received a fair trial. It's up to us, those around the world, those in the United States, those in Philadelphia, to create the context, to create the power, to build the grassroots momentum that will force our courts to address his long-standing issues, including evidence of innocence, including evidence of police and prosecutorial misconduct. It is those actions that we take that will build the context. Our judicial system in the United States is never impartial and fair, nor has it ever been. It is always up to the people to make sure that these people that are still inside, part of the mass incarceration, part of the diaspora of our people who are taken from our families, that they are given a fair hearing and that they are released and that our communities are returned to being whole. As in terms of a legal update, there are many, many paths to Mumia's freedom that are open. They are all political, and they have always been political. They have always been based on power. And so it's our job to build that, both legally within the courts, within the frameworks of parole, compassionate release, pardon, those avenues, legislation, as well as in the criminal courts of the Philadelphia Common Pleas Court, and through actions to demand that the district attorney reveal the corruption that happened in this case and many other cases. So thank you for listening. Thank you for your patience. Thank you for your grace. And thank you for everyone around the world, including those in Mexico City, who are standing up for justice, standing up for Mumia, who seek abolition, and who join us. Noel Hanrahan, Prison Radio, the Redwood Justice Fund, for Mumia Abu-Jamal and all those who seek freedom.
Okay, the woman behind Prison Radio, quite a project, prisonradio.org. Let's go right on to Amy Goodman's commentary, and she's talking about press freedom and its precarious state. I didn't mention I've got something from the encyclical that the Pope did. There's a lot of stuff going on about the Pope, not enough about his encyclical on the environment and the conferences he had. Got something from that. The quip that stuck out to me was it's the first papal encyclical that includes a PowerPoint, and the scientists that put it together. This is an archival thing that's from TUC Radio, but I thought since that part of his legacy is getting very short shrift, surprisingly to me, though the self-censorship of the press is notorious. And oh well, sorry for clicking my lips there. Here's Amy Goodman's commentary.
Press. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. President Donald Trump hates the press perhaps as much as he loves it. Since his 2015 embrace of electoral politics, though, his lifelong craving for headlines has been at odds with adversarial journalism that holds him to account. Thus, he attacks the press as the enemy of the people, insults journalists, and even incites violence against them. Now, in his second term, his attacks have multiplied, not only on news outlets that report his abuses of power, but on the very existence of a free press. Trump gave one of his more frightening speeches on March 14th before a large crowd at the Department of Justice. While the DOJ is supposed to be independent, Trump's rambling speech was essentially a roadmap to the assembled federal prosecutors and FBI agents gathered, directing them to launch his campaign of retribution against his perceived political enemies, including the press.
I believe that CNN and MSDNC, who literally write 97.6% bad about me, are political arms of the Democrat Party. And in my opinion, they're really corrupt and they're illegal. What they do is illegal.
While Trump may have never read the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, you can be sure that most of his audience that day had. The First Amendment reads in part, "Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press," unquote. Indeed, journalism is one of the only professions explicitly protected by the Constitution. In his drive towards authoritarianism, Trump isn't going to be deterred by 250 years of constitutional precedent. Robert Kuttner, co-editor of The American Prospect, laid out specifics around Trump's attack on the press, speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
They might go after the nonprofit tax-exempt status of much of the progressive media, so-called 501c3 status, that allows you to get foundation grants. And to be a 501c3, you're not supposed to be political. And, you know, just between us and your audience, a lot of the left press is pretty tough on Trump, as it ought to be. So Trump could go to the—now, it's illegal for the president to, abruptly pull the tax exemption of any organization. But you could get the IRS to launch an investigation, and you could find that, several progressive media are actually pretty critical of Trump. And maybe they don't deserve a 501c3 status. That in turn would spook their foundations because they're also 501c3s. They're tax exempt, and you could threaten their tax exemption. So that's just one thing he could do. You already have a kind of anticipatory capitulation, appeasement on the part of big corporate owners of the Washington Post and the LA Times. And sometimes the New York Times feels like it's pulling its punches because When a billionaire owns a media property, I hate the word, they have their other business interests to look out for, Sherry Redstone being a classical example.
Redstone is the heiress behind the multinational Paramount Global Media Empire, which owns a slew of media companies, including CBS, Paramount, the CW, and BET television networks, Comedy Central, and more. Redstone has been trying to engineer a merger between Paramount Global and Skydance Media, run by founder and CEO David Ellison, the son of tech billionaire Larry Ellison, the world's fourth richest person and co-founder of software giant Oracle. Sherry Redstone stands to reap billions from the merger, which still has to pass regulatory hurdles at the Federal Communications Commission. This might explain why Redstone, as reported by Semaphore, kept tabs on 60-minute segments on Trump, unquote. CBS's storied investigative TV news magazine was sued by Trump, claiming the show engaged in unlawful and illegal behavior in its edit of an October interview with his opponent, Vice President Kamala Harris. Redstone's reportedly seeking a settlement in what was widely considered to be a frivolous lawsuit to advance the merger. Amidst rumors of a CBS settlement with Trump, longtime 60 Minutes executive producer Bill Owens resigned. In a memo obtained by the New York Times, Owens wrote, quote, "Over the past months, it's become clear that I would not be allowed to run the show as I have always run it, to make independent decisions based on what was right for 60 Minutes, right for the audience," he wrote. Nobel Peace Laureate Maria Ressa knows something about attacks on the press. The founder of the Rappler News website in the Philippines suffered countless legal attacks and threats of arrest and violence under former Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte.
The biggest lesson we learned is that you are at your most powerful at the beginning of the attacks.
Ressa said on Democracy Now.
I'm a traditional journalist in the old sense of the word, right? Like, and I didn't want to be an activist, but when it's a battle for facts, journalism is activism. So in our case, I said, we hold the line. This is the line where the Constitution gives us our rights.
Respected journalist Maria Ressa remains free, while former President Duterte is now imprisoned in The Hague, awaiting trial in the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity. A free press is a bulwark against authoritarianism. Trump knows this, which is why we all need to support and defend independent journalism while we still can. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Of course, the U.S. doesn't respect the, or it isn't affiliated with the international court, so we can't expect justice from another venue, which would be a good thing, in my opinion. The attack on the courts, that's something, and the attack on academia is something else I've got for the very end of the show. I don't know how much I'll be able to play on it, but a scholar from Chicago, University of Chicago, writing about affirmative action and a whole lot of other things. It's going to be the closer, Jeffrey Stone. Perilous times, free speech in wartime. What I haven't heard in the discussion, and I didn't hear it in the section that I previewed, this nearly hour-long interview, was nominally, the Congress has the power to declare war, so how can Trump and his Stephen Miller cohort use a wartime expedited deportation mechanism? There is a clause that says if we're under attack, it doesn't have to be a declared state of war, but it's ludicrous. Say we're under attack, but then he did get purchased with his, we're being invaded. All right, I mentioned, Representative Ammons, Carol, said that she was hoping for youthful people to take the place or at least supplement some of the activism by the gray hairs like me. And there was a lot of that at the campus rally and the community rally, parts one and two. March for Science on Earth Day. They don't have Earth Day up front, but April 22nd. So here's some audio from both of that. As a closer is Julie Pride, and she has the most, as I mentioned, global view of overall what's happening with the attack on science, the attack on law. So here's got a little bit of the chanting. They had some really clever chants. Turns out that a number of the words and phrases that are no longer allowed in discourse, according to the government, 500 or so at last count, peer review is verboten, according to the Trump administration. I guess they don't have any peers. Okay, this is from in front of the alma mater to the happy children of the future.
Stand up here, okay. So I am very excited that I get to introduce our speakers to you all today. So let me first welcome our very first speaker today, Dr. Joy O'Keefe. Dr. O'Keefe is a biologist here at UIUC. And she leads the Human-Wildlife Interactions Lab at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, where she and her students, who are also here in the crowd today, conduct conservation-oriented work for threatened and endangered bat species of North America. So everyone, give a warm welcome to Dr. O'Keefe. Hello, and thank you for joining us for the Rise Up for Science March. Happy Earth Day. In case you don't know me, as Dana just said, my name is Joy O'Keefe, and my science identity is bat biologist. In my lab, we study bats, working to find ways to protect and restore bat populations imperiled by disease, habitat loss, persecution, and other factors. In celebration of Earth Day, I want to introduce you to an endangered species that I know well, pictured here on this sign and just identified by a student in my lab, the northern long-eared bat. As you might detect from its name, the northern long-eared bat has long ears. And when they're searching for prey, northern long-eared bats emit very high frequency, very short duration, rapid fire echolocation calls, as many as 10 calls per second. Their hearing is so finely tuned that they can hear echoes from moths perched on tree branches and attack those moths from a hovering position. That is a cool bat. Before they were given federal protection under the Endangered Species Act, back in 2015, the northern long-eared bat was one of our most captured bats. But a deadly fungal disease, white nose syndrome, caused a precipitous drop in their numbers, so great that for many years we didn't find them in our nets during summer surveys, and they disappeared from their winter hibernation sites too. Encouraged by testimony from top scientists, when we listened to scientists, Congress began allocating funds to a white nose syndrome response shortly after the disease was discovered in 2007, with a very small annual budget. The National Office for the White Nose Syndrome Response, housed within a federal agency, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, has supported hundreds of research projects, large and small. Studies on bat ecology, hibernation physiology, vaccines and other means of fighting the fungus, and more. Many federal agencies have risen to the call, the bat signal, if you will, working feverishly to learn more about once common bat species that are disappearing before our eyes. We can thank federal funding for enabling so many cool discoveries about bats. You might know the National Science Foundation, an agency that typically funds basic research questions about biology, behavior, or evolutionary processes. But for the applied work I've done with bats, the funding has come from the departments of agriculture, interior, defense, transportation, and NASA. Because Congress and the president have always prioritized federal funding for science through these and other federal departments, the United States of America has been the global leader in science for more than 80 years. The U.S. became a superpower in science because the federal government strategically partnered with universities to fund innovative science. But now these critical partnerships are at risk. And federal agencies themselves are being slashed with thousands of sudden job cuts. No plans in place to maintain the vital services these agencies provide. These cuts are devastating because federal funding isn't just vital to bat populations, it's crucial to student education and training. Yeah. My field of wildlife biology can be an exclusive space, given the remote environments where we work, the specialized knowledge and gear needed for success, but I've been delighted to welcome more diverse students to this space, oftentimes even first-generation college students who are earning their PhDs. And I've been thrilled to see the shift in the culture of our field. Our national organization, the Wildlife Society, now has working groups for women, queer people, Native Americans, Latinos, and people with disabilities, with overt, visible support from the leadership of this society. In recent years, many scientific societies have endeavored to create inclusive spaces at their conferences and in their practices. But what about our federal government? Recently, the new federal administration has attempted to crush diversity, equity, and inclusion and access efforts in science by cutting off grant funds for federally funded projects with DEI components and by threatening to pull funds from colleges and universities that embrace DEI. Some institutions have obeyed in advance, cutting DEI programs for fear of the financial threats to science endeavors. International students on our campuses are afraid, and it's going to be tough to do good science if you're worried about being taken into custody by ICE or having your visa revoked. The United States will lose the race for talent and innovation because talented people aren't going to want to work in such an environment. It's easy to see how this campaign of intolerance and exclusion could set us back. But I am here to say, and I hope that you'll say it with me, we will not go back.
We will not go back.
As we march on this 56th anniversary of Earth Day, which began here in the United States, I want us to lift up the dedicated scientists who doggedly pursue obscure fields like bat biology because it's their passion. Let's hear it for the landmark legislation that protects wildlife and natural ecosystems and that ensures we all have clean water and clean air. Let's continue to have the foresight and the courage to prioritize funding innovative science to find solutions to global problems and to improve people's lives. And let's all commit to making sure the science can be done by anyone, anywhere, so that science is for everyone. Thank you. Thank you so much to Dr. Joy O'Keefe. All right, and I'm excited to introduce our next speaker, which if you were with us for the Stand Up for Science, then you might recognize his name. I am very happy to introduce Dr. Scott Oswald. He is a postdoctoral researcher here at UIUC with a focus on applying computational biology to plant and crop sciences. Having been affected by the funding and by the cuts to federal funding and federal institutions, he is here to speak today to yet again Stand Up for Science.
Thank you, Dana. Happy Earth Day, everyone. Can you hear me all in the back? Great. So yeah, I'm here today not as a scientist, but as a private citizen to say why government investment in the sciences is important. 200 years ago, 2 out of every 5 children did not live to see their 5th birthday. The death of a child was a common, ordinary tragedy. And today it is a tragedy most parents will never bear. Today, fewer than 1 out of 20 children die before age worldwide. And in the US, the world's wealthiest country, fewer than 7 out of 1,000 do. Diseases, smallpox, typhus, scarlet fever, polio, and so on have effectively been eliminated. Malnutrition and starvation have effectively been eliminated. Vaccines, better hygiene, and abundant food have saved countless lives, and they are the product of scientific research. 200 years ago, humanity did not know what made people sick, why some people got sick and others didn't, and today we do know. That knowledge has saved countless lives. Knowledge is power, and new knowledge has changed our world for the better in many more ways. Discovering new knowledge is an investment in the future of our country, our society, an investment in the future of humanity. The discoveries we make today will pay dividends for years to come. For example, in 2020, we all experienced a global pandemic, but within the same year, a vaccine became available. A vaccine with over 90% effectiveness at preventing disease. Most people do not know that the mRNA COVID-19 vaccines were developed within the first few weeks of 2020, before the global lockdowns, before most people who died of the disease had died. The first clinical trials for the Moderna mRNA vaccine began only 5 days after the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 to be a global pandemic. It took nearly a year of testing, not to develop the vaccine, but to ensure it was safe and effective. But this miracle of speed in vaccine development was only possible due to more than 20 years of research to develop the knowledge and the technology that made the COVID-19 vaccines possible. Without this prior investment, a COVID-19 vaccine would have taken far longer than 1 year to develop, and so many more people would have died, and many more lives would have been disrupted. 20 years of investment in scientific research saved those lives, and as the cliche goes, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Since World War II, the U.S. federal government has become one of the world's biggest patrons of scientific research. In recent years, the federal government invests around $135 billion each year. Yes, that sounds like a lot of money, but it's less than 1/5 of 1% of the total budget. And the value of new knowledge is well worth the cost. However, the current government has decided to eliminate much of the funding for research, to lay off the workforce of many federal agencies that conduct research and that support research outside the government. Even though these public services have been approved by the people's representatives in Congress, the current administration says they do this to improve the government's efficiency. And while I will not deny that the way scientific research is funded has some problems, and we all desire for greater efficiency, how will we be prepared for the next pandemic if the government no longer invests in the sciences? How will we be ready for the effects of global warming? How will we remain a leader in technology and innovation? Even if its role must change, the government should invest in its people and their future. It should invest in scientific discovery. While the future may at times seem bleak, We are not powerless to change its course. Together, we can make a difference. Together, we are strong. Together, we will be heard. Let us take action, both big and small. Call your political representatives, regardless of party, and express your support for the government's investment in the sciences. Tell your friends and coworkers why you think this investment is important, and invite them to take action too, because together, we can change the future. Thank you for coming to show your support. And enjoy, let's enjoy the march, everyone.
Scott Oswald, computational biologist, so he knows how to run the numbers. Haven't heard a full-throated defense of the mRNA vaccine in a while. You hear, see a lot of crap. Opinions expressed are those of the speakers. About halfway through, as usual, I have much more than I can play. We'll be giving short shrift to the stuff about Harvard and attack on the university, as well as there is a discussion of affirmative action and DEAI. Mitch Jesuits, who's in a wheelchair, is always adds the A for accessibility. It's also included. That's under intact too. So, all right. Now a woman who will be named here. But let's see. I guess I do have it. No, I don't. She is from the Macomb area, and she's working Prairie Rivers Network, which is based here, but has places. Anyway, the money that she'd been working on a grant, working with farmers and stuff, as she talks about, has been pulled, but they're planning on trying to keep it going anyway. Back to the street. Actually, I think I got some chants here. I thought they were quite clever.
My name is Randa Watts, and I work for the environmental nonprofit Prairie Rivers Network, also known as PRN. As many of you know, PRN has been working for decades to fight coal pollution, like the coal ash on the banks of the Middle Fork River in Vermilion County. We have also been helping communities transition to clean energy to reduce carbon emissions and stop pollution before it starts. I came to work for Prairie Rivers Network last year with federal funding to provide technical assistance on environmental issues to disadvantaged communities. These projects didn't just help the environment, they brought jobs, stability, and hope to communities long overlooked. I have had the honor of connecting with rural communities across Illinois, helping them access federal funding to clean up pollution, address flooding, explore clean energy, and even build community gardens. Sitting down with community leaders to understand their unique needs, assets, and barriers allowed us to develop meaningful relationships that have lasted long after the grants were submitted. We spent over a year working with a rural, disadvantaged community to help them apply for a FEMA grant. This 55-page proposal would have addressed water pollution and flash flooding in their community, making them more resilient now and in the face of climate change. 7 days before the grant was due, our federally funded technical assistance program that allowed us to support these communities was terminated by the Trump administration. Let me say that again. PRN's program that helps struggling communities address environmental contamination, save money with solar energy, and access federal funding was eliminated. And what's more, the very FEMA grant we had helped that rural community apply for was completely cut shortly after the community submitted their application. Under the Trump administration, we've watched attack after attack on funding for pollution cleanup, clean energy, and climate resiliency programs, all for short-term political gain and the profits of polluting industries. Despite the loss of federal funding, Prairie Rivers Network will continue to work hand-in-hand with these communities to help them clean up and stop pollution and plan for cleaner, more resilient futures. We will do this work with our own money from members like all of you here today who are doubling down and supporting our efforts. In addition to cutting funding and dismantling climate and energy programs, the Trump administration is seeking to give coal a new life. Recent executive orders signed just 2 weeks ago have sought to prop up coal by rolling back regulations that protect clean air, clean water, and public health. Thankfully, in 2021, Illinois passed nation-leading climate legislation, giving us hope for a cleaner future in our state. But we must continue to push for progress, which is why we are back in Springfield this year fighting to pass the Clean and Reliable Grid and Affordability Act. Today, we are here to march for science, but we are also here to march for the communities whose very livelihoods and futures are being directly impacted by this administration's reckless disregard for American lives. Thank you all for being here today to make your voices heard, and thank you for standing with us to push back on federal climate and energy attacks and to advocate for Illinois' state climate action. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Randa. And we have one final speaker before Wendy sends us off for us to enjoy the People's Science Fair. So I'm really excited to introduce you to our next speaker, Julie Pride. Julie has served in many, many roles, such as the University of Illinois Institutional Biosafety Committee, the Chancellor's Campus Community Compact to Eliminate Racism, and is the co-chair for the 21st Century Initiative for Illinois' Public Health. So she is a very important member of our community, and we're very excited to have her speak here today. So without further ado, thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. I speak loud. I want to make sure that they're hearing me clear over in East Urbana. So again, my name is Julie Pride, and I am the proud administrator of Champaign-Urbana Public Health District. Our entire profession stands upon the research that is done at universities and institutions across the world, and we are going to be desperate without it. people have no idea how much this affects their lives, but hopefully they won't have to find out. But for the past 30 years, I have been working in public health, and I have witnessed some serious nonsense from the federal government, but I have never witnessed anything like this current authoritarian attack on science, research, public health, and common sense. Make no mistake, what we are witnessing today is an attempt to change our democracy to an autocracy. Christine Pagel, professor of operational research and healthcare in the UK, explains that the Trump administration is following the authoritarian playbook that has been used around the world and throughout history. Number one, control of science to align with state ideology. Number two, boo indeed. Number two, undermining the independence of universities and suppressing dissent. Number three, maintaining geopolitical and economic goals. This is most evident in the current administration with the appointment of Robert Kennedy Jr. as Secretary of Health and Human Services. He is uniquely unqualified for this position. Not only does he have zero education, training, knowledge, or skills related to science, scientific research, public health, or medicine, he actually appears to even have just a tenuous grasp on reality. He was appointed for one reason and one reason only: to create uncertainty and more distrust in the programs, services, and policies that were created through generations of scientific research at universities and institutions around the world. We know exactly what Kennedy means when he said he will, quote, find a cure for autism by September of this year. Spoiler alert, it will be vaccines or any other thing that the administration wants to discredit. People will die from the misinformation that is being pushed at the federal level in the United States in 2025. We are already seeing it with the ever-widening measles outbreaks and the children who are experiencing liver damage because their parents are being lied to and told that vitamin A is a preventative for measles. It is not. Children are needlessly dying in this country despite us having access to a safe and effective vaccine that has been available and studied extensively since the 1960s. I know that this group, more than most, understand what's at stake during this dark time in our history, but we are not helpless. We not only have the education, knowledge, and experience that is so lacking in this administration, but we also have the skills and creativity to fight back and move forward. I would like to end this with something hopeful from Dr. Ann Toomey, Associate Professor of Environmental Sciences at Pace University in New York City. She's author of the book, Science with Impact: How to Engage People, Change Practice, and Influence Policy. Number one, follow the social science. There is evidence out there. Get informed about what works and what doesn't work in changing people's attitudes and behaviors. Be savvy and strategic. Focus your efforts specifically and intentionally and look for existing actions to support. Number three, and this is hard for me, avoid denialist labels. It is important to recognize that those who are most distrustful and skeptical of science are often those who feel that science is not connected to their lives in any way. Help them make those connections. And I want to do a big shout out to my favorite podcast, which is started here at the University of Illinois. It's called This Podcast Will Kill You, and it is fabulous, and it is a great way to connect back to the diseases that are most people don't remember. Number four, build science capital, not just science literacy. Become known in your communities and your micro communities as a scientist. Explain what you do in ways that will help people feel connected and understand how the science impacts their lives. Number five, engage in advocacy and policy, but do so carefully. Be a resource to the experts who are experts in policy making. Be the scientific experts to help them. Donate time and money, but especially money, two things that were suggested: the Natural Resources Defense Council and Protect Democracy. And of course, always look to local places to park your money. Good Lord, it's windy. Right. Number seven, sustain your energy for the long haul. Take time to feel, grieve, and regroup. These are not normal times, and it is important to acknowledge the emotional toll of what's happening and help others do the same. And number eight, which we're doing today, find hope in collective action. Join and support advocacy organizations working to maintain our democracy. While Dr. Toomey felt that having a science march excludes people, I do not. Any peaceful protest that is open to all is very important work. Look around you. Give yourselves a hand. This should make us all hopeful. Take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and keep causing good trouble.
Julie Pride with a great, great short talk there. Amazing. That was from the parking lot at Lincoln Square after the march from the alma mater on Earth Day, the March for Science and People's Science Fair. And Rise Up for Science, new group. I guess it might be a registered student organization. Rise Up for Science.com. It's their website. University YMCA had a hand in it, too. All right. The Pope. There was a hour-long show on sibling station WILL about the Pope, and I was the one who brought up the Laudamus Si. What is it called again? The encyclical that includes a PowerPoint. First encyclical. Laudato Si. From 2017 or so. One scientist, a German fellow, Johann Schellenhuber, gave a talk, and this was excerpted on the show Time of Useful Consciousness, and I guess I'm going to suggest that you find that. Actually, you can go to the Vatican.va YouTube channel and see it if you'd like. There are some really good insights, and it shows how vested interests are not appreciative of even his climate activism, the late Pope's climate activism, because it is tied to equity and the climate debt to the countries that didn't contribute to the carbon dioxide, which is the lower 2 billion people in the world. Instead, I guess I'll play a longer piece from this Letters in Politics segment about the chilling effect on campuses, the law firms. They go into some other things, but I've only previewed the 20 minutes or so that I was hoping to get on, and now it's going to be shorter than that. I should do something about the tower update. We're still trying to approach the 45 grand goal. We did match a $10,000 matching grant in the early stages of this. You can donate online at WEF.org. You can drop a check down here, slide it under the door. Nobody's here. We're on automatic pilot some of the time. Here's an interesting way to donate. A portion of the proceeds for the special fundraiser held on Wednesday nights in April. Is there one left? I guess there is. Mark's on first. Sports bar, maybe? I don't know. Who's on second? In Gibson City are being donated to WEF. So if you're out listening in the western area, and you might want to, I guess they have a regular fundraisers in April. Maybe they continue that. Merry Travelers is a local band associated somewhat with the Rose Bowl. Through the end of April, their merchandise sales are being donated to WEFT. Their website is merrytravelers.com, and they're matching that too. So buy some merch. They have some neat stuff, I'm sure. Clever people they are. And so whatever you spend will go to WEFT, and it'll be doubled. Okay, let's go to Mitch Jeserich and his introduction to, is it Benjamin Stone, University of Chicago professor. We'll get on what we can, a constitutional look at Trump and the courts. Doesn't go into all of the details about ignoring court rulings, even if they are lame, they're still out there. And now they're escalating things by trying to distract people by arresting this judge in Milwaukee. I hope she'll have a platform to speak from. Indeed, she should.
In federal court on Monday in order to try to stop the cuts of billions of dollars in federal government support to the university. The university claims that the White House is arbitrarily and unconstitutionally punishing Harvard for exercising its own constitutional rights. Harvard is just one of a number of universities that the Trump administration is targeting for schools who are refusing to hand over information to the government about students, for having diversity programs, and for allegedly demonstrating political bias in the educational programs. It's not just universities Trump administration is targeting. It's also going after high-profile law firms that are seen in the past as having been supporting Democratic causes. And instead, the Trump administration is trying to coerce them and has successfully done so with some agreements to work on issues that favor Donald Trump's agenda. Today, we are going to be joined by a guest who has written a number of books on the history of the Constitution and on the courts, and we've talked to him about many of them, and I get the sense that many of the books that he has written are at the heart of many of these matters that the country is grappling with today. Our guest is Jeffrey R. Stone. Jeffrey Stone is the Edward H. Levy Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago. Again, he's author and co-author of many books, including Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime, A Legacy of Discrimination, The Essential Constitutionality of Affirmative Action, and The Free Speech Century. Jeffrey Stone, it is a good pleasure to welcome you back to this program.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
And again, as I said in my introduction, I feel like I've interviewed you about three or four books, History of Free Speech, History of Affirmative Action, that I think has a strong connection to the story around DEI today that we'll get into. We see what you're working on a book now about universities and free speech and the government and what's happening. So I just want to begin by asking you, what do you make of this moment overall that we're living through, especially when it comes to the Constitution or understanding of the Constitution?
Well, this is a truly unprecedented moment of government attempted abuse of power to manipulate universities, law firms, and other entities in our society in a way that is clearly a violation of our Constitution. And this is a moment when our democracy is very much at risk. And it will depend upon both those institutions and the judiciary and members of the state legislatures and Congress to stand up for those rights and for those interests that are fundamental to who we are as a nation.
Tell me about, I mean, just, is it a common violation, you think, of the Constitution of what the Trump administration is doing, whether if it's directed towards law firms or directed towards universities, or are there different issues at play?
No, this is unprecedented. We have never in our history seen a situation in which government has attempted to manipulate and to distort the behavior of law firms, universities, and other entities in a way that conforms to the government's own preferences. This is truly a remarkable moment, and it is a moment in which our democracy and our liberties are in jeopardy.
What are the constitutional issues at play here?
Well, the most fundamental one has to do with the freedom of speech and academic freedom. Freedom of speech is fundamental to American democracy. The framers of our Constitution, when they adopted the Bill of Rights, adopted as the First Amendment the guarantee of freedom of speech and of the press. And they understood that in a free society, it is essential that individuals and academic institutions, they weren't thinking about academic institutions at the time, have the independence to make their own decisions for themselves about what views to express and what positions to take, and that is at the core of what a democracy is about. And so what we're seeing now is a threat to that, really, that is unprecedented. We've had moments before, to be clear, in which there have been serious threats to freedom of expression in our nation. During World War I, for example, the government made it a crime for people to criticize the war or the draft, and some 2,000 people were convicted and put in jail for criticizing the war or the draft. And during the Red Scare, the government punish people for advocating communist and socialist views. But at least then it was specific points of view that would be criticized. Now it's the government attempting to dictate across a broad range of issues what it is that individuals and organizations can do and what they can express. So as I said, we're facing a situation in which the government is seeking unprecedented authority to dominate. And it's quite unnerving, frankly, in terms of the past and future of our society.
When it comes to the First Amendment and the right to free speech, and our understanding over time of what that amendment means has changed as we've talked to it. In fact, we have a sort of a different sense of what the First Amendment means in the past 100 years than the 150 years before that. So with the drafting, could it be argued when the framers came up with the Bill of Rights in the first session of Congress, and had this, the number one, the First Amendment on free speech, did they even have a notion that this would apply to a federal government that was, you know, providing money for institutions?
That was not the context in which they were focusing on their concerns. Their concerns at that time were on government essentially making it a crime or civil liability for individuals engaging in certain types of expression. But as the world has evolved and as our government has evolved, the government's authority and power has expanded dramatically. And there's no question but that the core principles of the First Amendment are applicable to the current situation in a very serious way when they're challenged in the way in which they're being challenged now.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is, has the courts taken up an issue concerning free speech when it comes to what the federal government provides money for or support for, actively supports something? Like, I mean, I would have free speech. I can go out on the corner of the street, say whatever I want. Government's not going to fund me for doing that. Has it ever been worked out what happens? How much sway does the government have over speech when it's providing the funding for a particular function?
It would clearly be unconstitutional, for example, for the government to decide to give money only to Republican political candidates, but not Democratic political candidates. That would be an open and shut case. So giving money can be a violation if it's done in a discriminatory manner. Giving money to white people, not black people, would violate the Equal Protection Clause. And giving money to Christians, but not Jews, would violate the Constitution. So yeah, giving money certainly can violate the Constitution if it's done in a way that's inconsistent with fundamental constitutional values.
How do you see this unfold? So Harvard files this case yesterday against the Trump administration. Is it a free speech case? Are they relying on the First Amendment in that case?
Part of it is a free speech case. Part of it is a question about the enforcement of federal anti-discrimination law. So part of it says that there are anti-discrimination laws that the federal government has enacted, and that if a university like Harvard violates those laws, it can be held accountable. And if it does violate those laws, the government can, for example, refuse to provide certain funding to the institution. But part of Harvard's case is that the government has not taken any of the procedures that the law requires in order to determine whether, in fact, there has been a violation of those laws. Those laws basically say that, you know, a university cannot, for example, engage in discrimination against people of a particular race or religion or gender and so on. And if you want to penalize a university for engaging in that behavior or withdraw funds from a university that engages in such behavior, the law provides that you have to bring an action against the institution and prove that they've in fact violated that law. And there's a procedure that has to be followed. You can't just say, we think you violated the law and we're going to withdraw funding because we think you violated the law. So part of the claim is that to the extent that there is an argument that the government is making, however ill-founded it may be, that Harvard has, for example, discriminated unlawfully against, say, Jewish students, that even if it had in fact done so, the government cannot punish Harvard for that unless it can prove through the judicial and administrative process, which the law dictates, that it is in fact engaged in that impermissible activity. So part of the case says that to the extent you are alleging that we violated certain non-discrimination laws, you have to prove that in the manners that the law requires. And here the government hasn't done that. It's simply saying, we think you've done this and we're going to take your money away. That's simply a violation of those laws. The second element of the claim is the constitutional claim, which is saying that the government is essentially attempting to interfere with the academic freedom of the Harvard University in terms of how it teaches classes, who it can hire, what kinds of courses it has to teach, and so on, all of which are protected by the First Amendment, none of which violate any federal laws. And the argument is that any intrusion by the government in those decisions by a private university violates the First Amendment rights of the institution to academic freedom.
So has academic freedom been worked out in the courts? Have there been landmark cases when it comes to academic freedom?
Sure. I mean, the court has certainly recognized that universities do have academic freedom and that they cannot be prohibited from engaging in certain types of activity without showing that that activity violates a constitutional law. A simple example would be if the government were to say that universities cannot teach certain topics like history or like equal rights, then a university could sue and claim that violates the First Amendment rights of the universities, and they would absolutely win. There's no question about that.
The Trump administration is citing in its actions towards Harvard University and other universities the Civil Rights Act, the monumental Civil Rights Act, and I think specifically Title VI, if I recall. I don't have it right in front of me, but if I recall correctly, Title VI of the Civil Rights Act.
Well, one of the claims they're making is that the university has engaged in unlawful discrimination, in particular against Jewish students. And if, in fact, the university has engaged in impermissible discrimination against Jewish students and violated federal law, then it can be penalized subject to the provisions of the statute. But in order to prove that, you have to prove it. You have to have a proceeding in which the government presents evidence that there has been a violation and that a determination is made that such a violation has occurred. And the university can then appeal that to a court claiming that that's an erroneous decision if, in fact, the decision is made in favor of the government. None of that's happened. So again, even if the government is making a claim that there's a violation of federal anti-discrimination law, it has to prove that there's a violation. It can't just say it and then go ahead and penalize an institution any more than it can arrest somebody and say, you know, we think that you committed murder, we're going to put you in jail for life without giving them a trial. You can't do that. That has to be a trial first.
Is the principal case the Trump administration is making is based on that they're claiming civil rights are being violated?
That's one of the claims that they're making. That was the initial claim that they were making, that there was a discrimination on the part of the university that violated federal law. They have not proved any of that. Yeah. But they're also going way beyond that and attempting to regulate the institution in ways that have nothing to do with that, in terms of, for example, dictating curriculum and deciding who could be hired. Those decisions go far beyond anything that the governing statute would cover.
And are they threatening funding over that as well?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
We're gonna look at what your curriculum is. We're gonna look at who you're hiring.
They're dictating that you have to make those changes. That's the penalty that we're imposing upon you. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you don't make these changes, then we will withhold your funding.
Right. I mean, the simple reality is the law requires that if the government believes that anyone, an individual, a university, whatever, has done something incompatible with the law, they have to prove it. They can't just say it and then punish them without actually proving it. And in this instance, the government has done nothing to demonstrate, consistent with administrative law or statutory law, that Harvard or other universities have done anything that violates law. And maybe they have, maybe they haven't. But the government has to prove that before it can impose any penalties.
This is Letters on Politics, and we are in conversation with Jeffrey R. Stone, who is the Edward H. Levy Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago. He's the author on many books concerning constitutional law, including Perilous Times, A Legacy of Discrimination, which is the essential constitutionality of affirmative action, which I want to talk about here in a moment, and the Free Speech Century. Let's turn to affirmative action, because it feels like so much about what is driving Trump and these policies is based around diversity. Today, we call it diversity, equity, and inclusion, and accessibility. But I kind of feel like...
That's Mitch Jezerich from Tuesday this week with... Jeffrey Stone of University of Chicago. If you want to hear his discussion on affirmative action, you can look for it as a podcast under Letters and Politics. It's the name of the show. As I walk away, why don't I just play Rick Ebenchon's reading of an announcement here for underwriting, since I am come up short. Views and opinions that you hear here are those of the station, not necessarily those of the station. They are those of the speaker. I'm well scripted today. Well, time for Radio Free Labor. I guess I'm going to hang around and like a bad petty return on the other side of the announcements here, because Gus is going to be in late. Maybe he's watching that new film that we were talking about, Juke Joints and Vampires.
Sinners.
Sinners, it's called, by Ryan Coogler. Interview on Democracy Now! This past week. Yeah, here's an underwriting announcement out of order. Better than not.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Elliott Counseling Group, who offers compassionate mental health care to individuals of all ages. Elliott Counseling Group serves Central Illinois with in-person and online sessions. More information is available at ElliottCounselingGroup.com. That's ELLIOTT Counseling Group, no punctuation or spaces.com, or by phone at 217-398-9066.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Minuteman Press. Whether you need signs for an event, thousands of full-color flyers, or personalized promotional items, Minuteman Press